Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. There was a mind meld recently between the New York Times and me. I'm writing a new ebook. It's a personal diary of sorts of how I like to cook on weekends. So I'm checking my cookbooks for old notes. I've always spouted off in the margins. And thinking about how we use cookbooks, we write in them. My favorite old books are the ones with people's notes, like the one that said, "This stew is just like the one Hattie made." Didn't like that one either. Well, the Times did an article about how we write in cookbooks when we'd never write in other books. But now what's going to happen with e-readers? A new app, anybody? Stick around for a lot more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Nigella Lawson is the British TV food celebrity who loves her food in spite of being movie star gorgeous, hangs out on the refrigerator door snacking at midnight, and takes great pride in being a home cook rather than a professional chef. But in a new TV show, The Taste, Nigella is judging contestants' cooking with three strong-willed restaurant chefs. Now, her other project is a new cookbook, Nigellissima, Easy Italian-Inspired Recipes. Nigella, welcome. Good to have you back.
Oh, it's always lovely for me.
You know, I'm looking at this new book. It's Italian food, and I had to chuckle. Somewhere around the first line, you said, "At 17, I decided to become Italian." What happened?
Well, you know, I don't know, because most people wanted to be French. And when I was a teenager, everyone was reading, French paperbacks and wearing berets and striped tops. But maybe it was my way of rebelling against my Francophile parents. But I don't know. So when love happens, it happens. And I just fell in love with the idea of Italy before I fell in love with Italy. So it could have been just a teen romance that was going to blow itself out. And yet I find myself several decades on as passionate about Italy as ever. I lived in Italy as a 19-year-old and have been back every year since.
Now, when you got to Italy as a 19-year-old, were you disappointed?
Well, not at all. Slightly afraid. I got there and I'd said I will do absolutely anything to earn a living except clean restrooms. And consequently got a job as a chambermaid where, of course, my job was to clean restrooms. So I learnt the equivalent, streetwise Italian. And then the reason I actually did want to learn Italian is I wanted to go to Oxford University and study medieval and modern languages, which I did. And I'd done Latin and French and German, but really wanted to learn Italian. But when I got back, of course, we were translating, I think it was Bertrand Russell, into Italian. And this poor professor said to me, "The grammar's all fine, Nigella, but I just don't think Bertrand Russell would have sounded like a Florentine greengrocer." But I learnt Italian because I wanted to speak to other people, and I found for me, I mean, this sounds like a very cheesy thing to say, that I'd been a very shy and reserved person in English and in England, and moving to Italy and learning Italian made me much more open and less timorous. So I suppose for me Italy represents a sort of coming into myself rather than just the acquisition of a foreign tongue.
What about the food? Were you prepared
fantastic.
For
Well, may I say, chambermaiding has never been a lucrative way of earning a living and remains remains like that. So in a way, I learnt about food the interesting way, which is with a very, very tight budget. And that's, I suppose, when you taste real food, because you don't have the money for fancy restaurants that tourists go to. So the simplicity of just a fantastic broth with some tortellini in, which is really, frankly, all I could afford when I went to a restaurant, was fabulous. And I learnt to cook things, which I still cook now, like eggs in purgatory, which is really chop a can of tomatoes, and you almost poach an egg in that, along with some chili flakes and some parmesan. And again, I always feel it sounds so odd. I feel like I'm telling lies when I'm telling the truth, which is that where I was chambermaiding, there was a granny there, la nonna. And she got quite lonely in the daytime because her children, it was her son, her very, very beloved son and daughter-in-law, would go back to their farm in the countryside in the daytime. And her grandson, Leonardo, was at school. And she got lonely. And although, of course, as staff, we were forbidden to go into the private parts of the pensione, she was lonely. So I used to go into the kitchen and keep her company. So I actually learnt to cook by watching her cook. So I feel I learnt in the old school way, and it was inspiring.
She sounds like she was straight out of Central Casting.
She really was. She was what they call a pocket battleship. You know, she was feisty to the max, and had a glorious head of dyed hair, obviously chestnut, and wore a sort of fitted apron with front and back at all times, always ready to be in the kitchen.
Let's talk about this show you're doing on ABC. It's called The Taste. And
yes,
your cohorts, you've got three men, all of them professionals.
I have.
And you're the home cook.
I am the home cook, but as the home cook and the only woman, I'm the voice of reason in all senses. But I think really there isn't a disparity between our aims, that really, if you love food, you love food. And many houses, there's fantastic food. And in restaurants, there's fantastic food. In some houses, the food is terrible. And we've all gone to restaurants where the food is terrible. So even though I do champion the home cook, and I think it's necessary because I think people are apologetic. Too many people say, I'm just a home cook, when, of course, it's home cooking that keeps the universe alive, at least the human race alive. But nevertheless, good food is good food, just as a good story is a good story. It doesn't matter who writes it.
I just think, though, that you chefs sometimes look at dishes because you four people are judging. You have Anthony Bourdain,
yes,
Brian Malarkey, the chef from San Diego, and then you have
the great Ludo Lefebvre.
Right, the French chef.
Who is really, talk about from Central Casting, he is a comedy French chef. I just adore that in him.
And so sometimes chefs have a point of view that's a bit different. I'm not denigrating the home cook. I'm one as well.
No. I think chefs sometimes, and actually chefs can overcomplicate, because the thing is, when it comes to the very basis, they are charging money. And people want to go out and they want to pay money for something they couldn't cook at home. So it can encourage, I think, a slightly manic pursuit of novelty, which doesn't always help, or it doesn't always aid pleasure, let's put it like that. And so I think sometimes it isn't better. The knife skills are obviously going to be more impressive, and there are all sorts of ways you can cook something that a home cook wouldn't have access to. There are very few things for me that would ever taste more comforting and more uplifting than a home-cooked roast chicken with mashed potatoes and some crisply cooked vegetables,
yeah,
and then a salad. So it's quite hard to improve. And I suppose what makes this programme slightly give an advantage to the home cook is that the dishes are tasted without, they're not plated, it's just a spoonful. So the ability of the professional chef to do that fancy footwork and plate decoration doesn't count for as much as it would otherwise. So maybe it just equals out the playing field or whatever cliche I'm groping for.
And also you're tasting with your eyes closed.
Yeah, well, I try to taste with my eyes closed because I feel that since I don't have the opportunity for a second mouthful, I have to concentrate fully, especially with those shouty boys. I need to shut my eyes and just go into some tasting sphere.
Now, you're one of the producers of the show. Is this what you wanted from the show?
I think so. I think it's a show that manages to be honest without being cruel. It seemed very important not to go into that sort of programming, reality programming, really, that gleefully humiliates people, that makes me cringe. And I think one of the advantages of Tasting Blind is you're only ever talking about the food. You're not talking about the contestants, so it's not personal. I mean, of course, no one wants to hear that their sauce hasn't worked or that there's too much acidity or not enough, but that isn't as hurtful as being, taken apart personally. So I think, I would like to think we all emerge with our integrity intact, but, you know, it's early days.
I'd like to think so. You're working with Anthony Bourdain, who can be pretty outspoken. I've never heard him hold back. Let's put it that way.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, I described him the other day as the Mick Jagger of food, and someone tweeted me and said, not the Mick Jagger of food, the Keith Richards of food. And of course, that was better. So I stand corrected. But the thing is that, yes, he's outspoken and he's honest, but actually there is something very eminently civilized about him, so that he wouldn't be personally rude. And in any time, I don't think he would be. I mean, he gets angry, but then no one gets as angry as the French Ludo. So they, as I said, there is quite a bit of shouting. And sometimes I do feel as if I have to knock their heads together, as we used to have to do to boys in the playground when I was a child. But most of all, it seems pretty good natured. But it's going to hot up, and it's going to get slightly more competitive. I mean, my difficulty is that I think that as a home cook, I don't have that slightly driven need for conflict.
Uh-huh.
So that's going to be interesting, whether I get outshouted by the boys.
Nigella, thanks for talking with us.
Lovely for me, as ever. As Evelyn.
Nigella Lawson appears on ABC's The Taste. Our latest cookbook is Nigellissima. Now, she has a recipe that's begging to be used on Valentine's Day. Meringue gelato cake with chocolate sauce. Stunningly easy, and the sauce, dynamite. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Can we talk about Greek yogurt for a minute? Our extra money isn't necessarily buying some marvel from Greece or yogurt with special cultures. Greek yogurt is yogurt that has some liquid drained off. This is not new. I mean, I'd lay good money on the fact that Plato was probably making it. You can do it with any good-tasting yogurt. My big splurge is whole milk, cream top, organic. But lean or plump, any yogurt can be turned Greek. Here's what you do. You line a sieve with a thin cloth, you set it over a bowl, and you add the yogurt. And you let it drain in the fridge until it's the thickness you like. An hour or two for the Greek style, and if you let it go overnight, you get a yogurt cheese that's good with bread and honey for breakfast or with pita, garlic, and olive oil for supper. So check out Make Your Own Greek Yogurt on the website, splendidtable.org. Now we're going to be back with Where Chefs Eat and A Quest for the Good Tomato. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Recently, Joe Warwick performed a public service on a global scale. Joe's based in London. He's a restaurant critic, outspoken food writer, and co-founder of the awards for the world's 50 best restaurants. In short, the man has contacts. Which brought him to asking 400 chefs from nearly everywhere to name their favorite places to eat. Fumble no more for where to eat in Estonia or California. Joe's taken it all on in his guidebook, Where Chefs Eat. Joe Warwick, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
You know, I'm looking at this book. Okay, it's got to be, I'd say about 3 to 4 inches thick. It's not heavy, thank goodness. This is great. 2,000 picks from chefs everywhere, from Latvia to Cape Verde. I mean, the only place you didn't hit was Antarctica, I think. How did you go about picking these people?
Yeah, I mean, we've actually got closer to 2,500 places and 400 chefs around the world. I mean, a lot of the chefs pick themselves, guys like René Redzepi, Pierre Gagnaire, Ferran Adria, David Chang, Daniel Boulou. So these are very well-known gastronomic chefs. And then beyond that, it was a case of, I mean, I was lucky enough, I worked on setting up a thing called the World's 50 Best Restaurants. And through that, I had connections with a lot of different gastronomic journalists and restaurant journalists around the world. You know, and if there was somewhere where I got stuck, I'd email them and go, look, you know, who do you think I should speak to in Brazil or, you know, wherever? And they'd get back to me with some ideas and we'd look at them and we'd send them off. So it was a research job, some of it. A lot of them I knew already. I think we probably ended up sending out surveys to maybe 1.5 times as many as we got back. I mean, when we started doing this, we were talking about doing 100 chefs and 500 restaurants, which was something I could get my head around.
and now to 2,500 recommendations.
And then it kind of snowballed. So, you know, and I think, you know, as we got going, if I'd had my way, we'd still be doing it. You know, we need a forklift. It wouldn't be such a manageable volume. We need a forklift to carry it around.
Well, it's really intriguing. I mean, I look at this and you think these places that you never think of. I mean, Newfoundland, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't sit down and say, oh, we're going to ask so many chefs from certain parts of the world. Obviously, there's big restaurant cities like Paris and Barcelona and New York and those sort of places we wanted to represent. But I thought about places like Canada and also places like New Zealand as well that tend to get neglected in other restaurant guides. And it was really interesting because the chefs there, I think maybe because those areas get neglected, they're doing great things and they really engage with it. So, you know, what we got back from a particular country was partly down to how the chefs responded to it.
This is the thing. I mean, I was looking at Newfoundland because it's not terribly far away. And, you know, it's so great to see the way in this book places that do get overlooked are not only spotlit, but we get some details. And I think it's the chef Jeremy Charles was one of the chefs who's in St. John's.
Yes, indeed.
And he had a bunch of recommendations for St. John's and other areas that just sounded fascinating.
Yeah.
But who surprised you the most with their picks?
I don't know if chefs surprised me. I think what we did, because we didn't just say to chefs, pick your favorite places, because what does that mean? We asked them to pick places for specific things. So from breakfast to late night, from cheap to expensive, from somewhere you couldn't find anywhere else in the world to the regular neighborhood joints. Mm-hmm. And the places that really connected with me as I was going through it and compiling it were maybe, because it's not just restaurants, you know, so there was hot dog stands, you know, there was a herring wagon in Stockholm. There's a thing called a wet burger in Istanbul I didn't know anything about, which seems to be a burger in a sealed bun. It's a wet burger, and they steam it in this incredibly pungent chili garlic sauce. It sounds absolutely fantastic and very messy. So those kind of places, Asia, you go to Hong Kong, there's a place called Underbridge Spicy Crabs, where the specialty is crabs. Those sort of street food places were really good. And I think what was interesting is, if you think about a very high-end chef who's cooking very complicated food, the assumption's maybe going to be that that's how they eat when they go out. And I think they do eat in those places to see what their peers are doing and keep up with the competition. But actually, when they go out and relax and they eat, they're into something a lot more casual or something a lot more real and direct. And those were the places that I thought were really interesting. And the late-night places as well, because, of course, chefs still work very long hours. And if you want to know how to eat late at night, well, anywhere, ask a chef.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and I think the places you're talking about are the places the locals go and most travelers never learn about. Now with the web, it's great because we've got a lot more access. But still, it's really great to have someone who really knows food be able to say to you, this is the one you want to try.
Exactly. And also, I think the thing is, as well as sometimes with guides that are compiled from surveys, you're asking yourself, who are the people filling in these surveys? You know, we don't know. They're anonymous. And particularly with stuff that's generated online as well, people review restaurants anonymously. So, you know, people go back to professional critics for trusted voices. But if you've got a chef putting their name on a place, they're putting their reputation online almost as much as they are when they cook for you. Because if they send you someone that's not up to spec, they're going to look bad.
Joe, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
British restaurant critic Joe Warwick's book is Where Chefs Eat, A Guide to Chefs' Favorite Restaurants. No self-respecting food lover is going to give up on the tomato. As bad as they can be, we live in hope, and occasionally we get to taste a glorious one. Reporter Arthur Allen went beyond just hoping to meet a great tomato. He set out to get the story for his book, Ripe, The Search for the Perfect Tomato. Mexican chef Patty Hinnich recently dug into the topic of tomatoes with Arthur Allen.
Arthur, thanks for joining us.
It's nice to be here.
Let me ask you something. There's some irony in the title of your book because it starts with Ripe, The Search for the Perfect Tomato. And we all know from reading the news, especially here in the U.S., that tomato growers, especially in Florida, do not let their tomatoes get ripe. So is that you did that on purpose, right?
Yeah. And also, I don't think there is really a perfect tomato. I mean, the perfect tomato is just presents itself in front of you on some magical day. But yeah, in Florida, interestingly, they've been running these farms for about 40 or 50 years this way, where they pick the tomatoes green, and I mean green and hard as, you know, baseballs. And it's come to be where they are producing 60% of the tomatoes there for the fast food market. And there's a certain kind of thing that you want on a McDonald's hamburger, which is a very thinly sliced tomato that doesn't, you know, get the bun all soggy, but you can get a lot of slices out of one tomato. And that's increasingly what they've sort of converted their tomato growing operations into there. I mean, I think they're trying to improve like everyone is, but they really, it's
so
a sad
story.
They're
looking for endurance
they're
in
looking
transportation.
For size and endurance.
Size
big
for
tomatoes
endurance.
And, you know, hard tomatoes that will travel well.
Now, the tomato seems to be one of those ingredients that many countries have appropriated. Right?
Right.
Mexicans say it comes from Mexico, but Italians boast about their San Marzano tomatoes. I hear now from you that the Chinese are also very proud about their growing tomatoes. In all your travels, you went to China and Italy and Mexico. Was there anything that struck you from each country as being very different in the way most people in each country viewed or perceived the tomato?
You know, in the United States, I in the opening of the book, I say that people used to throw tomatoes at politicians, but now they throw politics at tomatoes. Because everyone, there's all these debates. I mean, is it local? Is it a hybrid? Is it this, that, and the other thing? But when you go to Italy,
right,
which, you know, is such an important, tomatoes are so important to their food culture. I mean, all they really care about is the flavor.
Right.
And so it turns out that in Italy, for example, the best tomato, everybody was telling me when I was going over there, oh, the Pacchino tomato. And I looked around, and it turns out Pacchino is down in Sicily, like where the Allies invaded in 1943, this tiny little piece of Sicily that gets a lot of sun all year round.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there, and the guy told me, yes, the best tomato here is a tomato that was bred in Israel.
That is fascinating.
Yeah, and nobody cares in Italy. It's like, I mean, they don't really care if it's organic. I mean, people care about the environment, obviously, there,
right,
and how things, you know, the landscape and so on. But per se, whether it's organic is not important.
So tell me, what's the big deal with San Marzanos?
You know, I was going to ask you that. I really don't get it myself. I mean, I think they are perfectly okay, but I was given a taste test in the town of Battipaglia by a famous pizza maker, and he gave me real San Marzano and hybrid San Marzano and other tomatoes. And to me, the San Marzanos are kind of insipid. And he said, oh, è più delicato. And I was like, well, I guess one person's delicato is another person's insipid.
You just saved us a lot of money.
Glad to be of service.
Arthur, where did you find the best tasting tomato?
Well, it really happened when I was down at the very southern tip of Baja California at this organic tomato farm that was set up by this American couple, this incredibly idealistic American couple who'd set it up, and then it was basically taken over by and worked by all these small Mexican farmers. I mean, not short Mexican farmers, but you know, right. Small owners, owners of small amounts of land. And they were growing mostly cherry tomatoes. Mm-hmm. And one day we went out to this field in the middle of nowhere, and the whole place was covered with these golden berries. And they were just the most amazing thing I'd ever tasted. It was like mango and cantaloupe, sort of that, a bit of tart, but really sweet. And it turned out that something had gone wrong, and they'd had to turn off the water because it was leaking.
Right.
You know, the pipes were leaking. So they hadn't harvested any of these tomatoes because they figured they were all spoiled.
Right.
But it turned out that somehow the combination of the time of year, the soil, and the fact that they'd turned off the water a little earlier than usual made them, like, perfect.
So, Arthur, what did you want people to take away from this book?
Well, yeah, I just think that it's not a good idea to be dogmatic about food. I mean, I think being local is great, and I think it's great to support local farms. And everyone finds a small farm more appealing than a big farm, but there are some things that bigger farms do better, and it's never going to change. I mean, when you're making tomato paste, I've seen these operations where they make tons and tons of the stuff every minute. And I admired those people as well, so... You know, I'm not a very dogmatic person. The flavor is really important, and basic respect for other people in food as in other areas of life.
Right. Well, I think it is one enlightening read. Arthur, thank you for the conversation.
Thank you.
Arthur Allen wrote Ripe, The Search for the Perfect Tomato. Patty Hinnich hosts Patty's Mexican Table on PBS and is author of Patty's Mexican Table. Now, you can get her recipe for avocado hearts of palm salad with tomatoes on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, check out our recipe box, sign up for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, our podcast, and check out our e-books, Eating In with Lynn, splendidtable.org.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me.
It is time to connect with you. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Find us on Facebook. Check us out on Twitter. Shoot us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Daniel is on the line from Pittsburgh. Daniel, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Hi there. Thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome.
I wanted to ask you about cherries and baking. I have never seen a cherry pie recipe that didn't call for sour or tart cherries,
right.
And I was just wondering, can you bake with other cherries, and if so, what are the rules?
Well, okay, first of all, this is a major gripe of mine, that it's so hard to find tart cherries, and there's a fortune to be made out there for anyone who grows them, pits them, and even freezes them, you know, because, I mean, I see them occasionally in the frozen food case, and, you know, you can defrost them and drain them, and you're fine. But they're very rare, and for at least in my neck of the woods. So here's the deal with sweet cherries. A couple of tricks. Number one, you use a lot less sugar, and you use lemon. I use lemon with fruit pies anyway, you know, because it adds a kind of a sparkle to it. But when you want a touch of tartness, a bit more lemon would go into those sweet cherries. So this is what I would do. Whatever recipe you like, Start out by adding the sugar to the cherries until you get, and the lemon, little at a time of each, until you get them where you want them. Then add whatever the thickening agent is and bake away, and you're done. And then, and you and I will start a small campaign to get people to get tart cherries to us.
Awesome. No, I know that like adding the sugar to the cherries causes them to like start giving off juices.
Yeah.
So is it a little like, do I need to maybe wait a little bit less long than I would with like a tart cherry?
No. In fact, there's a great trick. Rose Levy Berenbaum, who's a baking genius, came up with this great pie trick with fruit pies, anything that throws off liquid. Flavor those cherries however you want to have them taste. Then put them in a sieve. This is before you add the thickening agent. Over a bowl. And let them sit for about an hour. And they're going to drain. You know, in so many words, you're really pulling moisture out of the cherry, so it's going to bake better. Take whatever's in the bowl, boil it down to a nice syrup, and add it back to the cherries. And you get,
awesome.
Yes, and you get two dimensions of flavor. You get this kind of intense cherriness, and then you get the more delicate fruit, fresh fruit cherriness. It's pretty exciting.
Awesome.
So there you go. You're going to be the paramount.
No one's going to know how my pies taste so good.
That's right. And you're not going to tell them.
Exactly. Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. And take care. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
800-537-5252 is how you can reach us. And by the way, that's a great trick. Remember, lemon. Lemon is the great accent. And when you get blah fruits or you want to have more of a perky, I think of it as a pointed flavor, I think pictorially. But anyway, more accent, think lemon first. And a bit of lemon rind, not too much, but just a little bit of lemon rind. And that trick of draining the fruit, it is the godsend. You don't get those soggy, you know, everything floating in the fruit juice kind of pies anymore. Emily is on the line from Oberlin, Ohio. Emily, welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Hello, Lynn. My question for you is, I've been trying my hand at a few DIY kitchen projects.
Right.
And looking for inspiration for what to do next. I've made yogurt, some different types of bread, goat cheese, granola, and I'm looking for maybe what's the most maybe cost-effective or valuable thing to make at home that you wouldn't expect.
I have to think for a moment. Boy, you're really going at it. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's
thank you.
Really great. You know, I was going to say butter, but the reality is that when you buy the really good cream and then whatever, make your own butter, it gets pretty pricey.
Right.
You know, one of the things you can do is spice blends.
Oh.
And I mean, because often there's a premium charge for, you know, pumpkin pie spices or Italian seasoning or whatever it is. And what I find is this saves me time, and it also is sort of my own custom thing. When I find there are certain combinations of spices I use a lot in a lot of different dishes. Like, for instance, I'm really into allspice, ginger, and black pepper. And I use that with tomatoes, you know. And I mean the dry ginger, fresh ginger when I've got it. And I also love the idea of allspice, cinnamon, and, you know, some hot chili.
Uh-huh.
So I'm making my own spice blends, but I'm buying the spices whole because they keep for a year, whereas pre-ground spices keep for, what, 3 months, and then they start to go flat.
Right.
So I use a coffee grinder. You could use a mortar and pestle, too. And they make great gifts. You know, when you go to somebody's house for dinner and you hand them some fresh grated orange peel that you've mixed with, you know, ground black pepper and a little bit of salt and some chili, they're going to like that a lot.
Thank you so much.
Keep up the DIY. This is great.
Thanks.
Take care.
You too.
Bye, Emily. We're going to be back to take more of your calls and get the final word on how to make a fine biscuit. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, it's time to connect with you, getting back to your calls. Pick up the phone. Call us, 800-537-5252. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Okay, who is up next? We've got Carrie calling from Oakland, California. Carrie, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi. I want to talk about making mayonnaise and hollandaise sauce and why they might not be working.
Okay. All right. all right. What's happening? Tell me what's happening right now.
Okay. So this question is actually for my husband, who does all the cooking. So I'm sort of acting as his proxy here because I don't do any cooking, but I eat all the wonderful food he makes.
I think you qualify to be able to ask the question.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So he's always, well, he tries off and on to make mayonnaise and hollandaise sauce from scratch. And I say off and on now because he stopped doing it regularly because it stopped working regularly. He used to make it all the time. And as far as we know, he does all the exact same things now. The only difference is that we moved across the country several years ago. And then since then, it's totally hit or miss. And we can't figure out why.
I wonder. Okay, where did you move from?
Okay, so we were in upstate New York.
Right.
And then we moved to California.
You know, technically it shouldn't make a difference, but what I wonder is, I mean, okay, let's talk about the variables. We've got oil, we've got eggs, and seasoning,
right, yes.
Right? Right, and technically it really should work. Has temperature changed at all? Because usually you want to do mayonnaise and you want to do hollandaise at room temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, the whole idea behind both of these is that one is where you're actually cooking the egg and the other one is where the egg is raw.
Uh-huh.
So mayo, you're not cooking anything. So, but the big key with this is that you do egg yolks, room temperature egg yolks, but that you, and you whip them with a bit of mustard, which is kind of a binder, and a little lemon if you'd like. But you go into a blender, or you can whisk it, but you add the oil drop by drop. And I just wonder, is he speeding up that process?
He might be. As far as he says that nothing has changed, and we can't figure out scientifically why. He has had a few times of successes making hollandaise in the blender, which he feels is kind of cheating.
Well, it is, in a way, but people do it.
But then it whips up okay. But otherwise, like everything, it just falls. It turns into egg soup.
Oh, Lord. Okay. Well, all right. Here's what I would suggest. Okay. And this is a trick. First of all, are you using pasteurized eggs by any chance?
I'm not sure. I think so.
Because
probably.
One of my concerns is about mayonnaise and hollandaise is, well, hollandaise you're heating. But with mayo, I like to warm my eggs and get them up to 160 degrees, even for a few seconds. So in so many words, the yolks go into a pan set over a pan of simmering water. And I just stir and stir, and I stick an instant reading thermometer in there. And once it's at 160, I pull it, scrape it into a regular bowl so that it doesn't cook. By the way, is he still using the same oil?
As far as I know, yeah.
Okay.
Always olive oil. So.
Yeah, all right, and that shouldn't change radically. Okay, here's what I would like him to do, all right? Room temperature egg, room temperature oil, room temperature ingredients. But most important of all, a bowl that is sitting so that it's really steady. This is for either one of them, but especially the mayo. You know, put it on a bunched up towel or whatever so he can really be whisking, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And drizzle in that oil. I mean, literally beat up a bit of mustard with his egg yolks and drizzle the oil. A teaspoon should take him about 15 to 20 seconds to add.
Okay.
Really slow. And you do that, you keep doing that until it starts to get creamy. Then you can add the oil a little faster. Now, I find it easiest to do mayo in a food processor because it just works really, really well.
And so I can tell them that's not cheating.
No, that's not cheating. The thing about doing hollandaise in a blender is you want to make sure those eggs are really cooked. You want to get the hollandaise up to a temperature of about 165 to 170 on an instant reading thermometer, which will totally stabilize the eggs and also make them absolutely safe. And sometimes that's hard to do in a blender. But the biggest key here is you add the oil very slowly because you want to start building that emulsion and have the proteins and all the other things in the eggs start to encapsulate that oil. And if you drop too much oil on it all at once, it will never, ever become creamy. See how that works.
Okay.
Okay? And
okay.
Other than that, this is a mystery, without a doubt. Okay. Hey, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Good luck with the mayo in the holidays. Bye.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
We have Ron on the line, and he's calling from Saline, or I'm not pronouncing it correctly. Is that Michigan, Ron?
Yes, it's Michigan. And, yeah, it is Saline, even though
Saline.
It's called Saline, yes.
Yes, okay, Saline. I got it right. Well, what can I do for you?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on your show.
You are welcome.
I was calling about banana bread, which I love banana bread. Actually, I back up. Mostly I love making banana bread, but it can be, it's kind of boring. I decided a while ago that I wanted to try to do something that would make it more interesting.
So right.
I tried a couple of different kinds of coatings for the outside, and, you know, something that would give it a little more wow.
Right.
And I haven't hit it. Two different ways that I've gone at it. Well, one of the ways was that I made a coating with walnuts and sugar, brown sugar,
uh-huh.
Some little tiny bit of cinnamon and allspice, and then vanilla, and actually put it on the bread while it was before it was done baking, but almost to the end, and then finished baking with that on the top and let it sort of caramelize.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like it would be great. How did it turn out?
It tasted great. The problem was that it was too brittle, so that when you cut the bread, you end up with, you know, chunks of this stuff all over the place, which wasn't successful. I wanted to stay with the bread.
Yeah. I wonder if a little butter in that mixture, you know, soft butter that you would work into that mixture might help it just glue into the top of the loaf, and adding it earlier.
Okay.
Giving it an extra 5 minutes or 10 minutes, and maybe even gently, kind of very gently pressing it into the top of the cake.
Okay,
Of the bread. That might help. Have you thought about marbleizing the bread with something interesting?
I've never done that before.
The idea is that you have an intensely flavored, almost like a syrup, okay, that you, when the batter is all done, you just put it in and barely stir. So the idea is you get a vein of it running through. And,
okay.
I mean, the first thing that comes to mind, which is kind of obvious, but what, you know, what could be bad, is chocolate.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
You know, and it's not that you stir it all the way in. You kind of swirl it in so you can see a pattern, and then you pour your batter into the pan.
Okay.
And so as you cut into it, you're going to get random streaks of this. Another thing that might be fun is making a sort of a butterscotch.
Mm.
Which would be caramelizing sugar, you know, just putting sugar in a pan with a little bit of water, mm-hmm. and gently cooking it, washing down the sides with a wet brush, because as it boils, the sugar is going to throw up crystals.
Okay.
Just keep washing that down with a damp brush until it turns a caramel color. Don't stir it. Just let her rip.
Okay.
And when it's a pale caramel, pull it off the heat and stir butter into it and vanilla. And don't taste it yet. It's going to burn your tongue.
Okay.
Let that cool down, and that becomes, that you can streak, because it becomes this lovely, thick kind of, you know, caramel sauce.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, and you can look up a recipe for any caramel sauce, rum caramel sauce, you know, vanilla caramel sauce, whatever it is, or butterscotch sauce, and that's exactly, you know, that's how you make it. And that could be just wonderful with the flavor of a banana bread, and then have that lovely kind of butterscotchy caramel taste. That could really be lovely. And you'd get, as I said, bits of it through the whole bread.
That does sound wonderful. About 2 weeks ago, you were talking to a caller about making a cake. She'd never really made cakes before.
Uh-huh.
She said, whatever you do, just don't just leave it on and stir, because you'll end up with a brick.
Yeah. It's called hockey pucks. Yeah.
Yeah. So what I've been doing is just barely even mixing it in. I mean, you know, mash it up, real nice ripe bananas, but so they got a lot of flavor, but then just barely mixing them in, and it makes the bread, it made the bread so much more.
What a great succulent. Tip. That's a great tip. This is, I think, if you do the same kind of thing with a syrup or the chocolate.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Give it a shot. I think you'll really enjoy it.
Thank you so much.
And I love the crunch idea on the top. I've been making mental notes.
Okay. All right.
Hey, thanks for a great call, Ron.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can call us 800-537-5500. 5252. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter and send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. You know, about every decade, it occurs to America that our own South's cooking is pretty extraordinary. Now, we're in one of those moments now. And there's a lot to love there. But the Southern biscuit, that's one of those separating the men from the boys achievements. So many types, so little time. Well, Natalie Dupre is one of the biscuit queens. You know her from her many series on TV on Southern cooking and her books. The latest is a life work of sorts. It's called Mastering the Art of Southern Cooking. Natalie, welcome.
It's good to be here.
Now, I want to talk biscuits with you because the biscuits I had at your house many years ago in Atlanta, that was my biscuit epiphany. I mean, they were like angel's wings. I had never eaten biscuits like this. So let's talk about that. Now, you break this down in the book, and I think you do a great job of it. Let's break down the process. First of all, the flour in the South is different from the flour anywhere else. So it's a self-rising soft wheat flour.
Right.
White Lily is one of the brands that everybody loves, right?
Right. There's Martha White as well. There's Southern Biscuit Flour. There are a lot of different ones. But their commonality is that they're winter wheat, or historically winter wheat. And so that meant they were grown in the winter, where Midwestern and Northern wheats were grown in the summer. And so they had lower gluten. And this was disparaged by the North, but it was wonderful for the South, where there was a tradition of English food, which included hardtack and some of those harder biscuits before the advent of baking powder. So it is lower in gluten. You can tell that by looking at the side of the package under protein.
So the protein content should be what, about 8 to 10 grams of protein?
Well, for Southern flours, they will go down to 8 or 9, and Northern flours or bread flours will go up to 14.
But if we in the North, if you mix all-purpose flour with cake flour, you should be able to simulate it. You have a formula
right.
in the book that tells
that's
you
right.
how to recreate that. So the that's the piece about the flour. Now, the fat, we're talking butter or lard or shortening.
Right, and whipping cream as well. I tell everyone, if they really want to make a perfect biscuit, go to the grocery store and buy lard, shortening, and butter, and whipping cream, and several kinds of flour,
right.
and go to their kitchen and lock themselves in and practice making the biscuit that they like the best, because everyone likes a different biscuit. And once you get to the biscuit you like, then you can learn to accommodate, if you want to, somebody else's biscuit or somebody else's mother's biscuit. So, but you have to practice. It's not something that people are born with. They learned from watching. For instance, Kate, who was a wonderful biscuit maker, and we break down her process.
Those were the biscuits I tasted in Atlanta. They were made by Kate Almond, right?
That's right, Almond, right.
Yes.
And Kate's dough was really always very wet. You can stick your finger in her dough, and there will still be dough clinging to your finger when it comes out, little speckles.
Right.
Not globby wet, but wet.
Right, and that allows for a lot more steam.
Yeah, and as the dough sits, interestingly enough, it does get drier. Sort of seems to absorb the flour a little bit. So if it's dry when you start, by the time you roll it out, cut it out, you're going to be in trouble.
Uh-huh.
Now, the three things that combine in making flour activated are liquid, manipulation, and heat. And then if you add fat, that will tenderize the dough. So we work our biscuit dough, and just like our pie dough, as little as possible. And the lighter the fat, the lighter the biscuit. And my favorite biscuits to teach with are the two-ingredient biscuits that we make, which are just self-rising flour and whipping cream.
Wow.
when we just lightly stir those two together and then plop them out, and there are some plastic boards that you can buy in the grocery store that fold, that are like $3 for $2. And if you have those on the counter and you just plop your dough out on them with it lightly floured, and then you fold those plastic sheets, or you fold it with your hands, pat it out, fold it again, pat it out,
so you're building layers like a puff pastry.
You're building layers like a puff pastry. You're not kneading it. Kneading is a vicious word. We don't knead biscuits. We manipulate them, or we pat them. So we pat and fold the dough in half twice, and then the third time we cut it out. And you can fold it more like a puff pastry if you want to, but we have a two-fold biscuit, and then the third time you cut it out. Then it splits easily so that you can put butter in it.
Natalie, thank you for teaching us how to make biscuits.
Thanks, Lynn.
Natalie Dupre is co-author with Cynthia Graubart of Mastering the Art of Southern Cooking. Now, a good launch for making biscuits is that recipe that Natalie talked about, two-ingredient biscuits, and it's on the website, splendidtable.org. And by the way, Natalie is a genius with tricks, and she has one for figuring out the hot spots in your oven. This is what you do. You lay out white bread slices on a cookie sheet, and you bake them. And then you'll see which part of the oven is hotter or cooler by what browns and what doesn't. Genius. Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for being with us. You have a great week, and until next time, let me leave you with this from Carl Sandburg, who said, "Poetry is the synthesis of hyacinth and biscuits." The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. On splendidtable.org, you can find information on anything you heard here today. For instance, our latest ebooks, podcasts, rifle through our recipe box, and register for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Manda Lilly. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.